for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Russians are observing a day of mourning following yesterday's suicide bombings in the Moscow subway that killed 39 and injured more than 70. Russian authorities said evidence indicates Muslim militants from the North Caucasus are behind the blasts. Joining me in the studio to talk about terrorism inside Russia, its new nuclear arms treaty with the U.S., and the Obama administration's evolving relationship with its former Cold War rival, Andrei Sitov of Itar-Tass, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy magazine, and Steve Andreasen of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Please join us. Your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Andrei Sitov, if I could start with you, what is the latest that we know on who was behind the bombings in the Moscow subway?
The authorities still are not saying anything definite. They say they regard as the main suspects, as you mentioned, Muslims from North Caucasus, the extremists, I should say, not the Muslims, because we're only speaking here about Muslim extremists. The people in the streets seem to be more convinced of that. That is the prevailing feeling. And we all know why. The Russian foreign minister also suggested that some of the extremists, some of the militants may have received training abroad, which is something that, again, comes with no surprise for the Russians, because ever since the war in Afghanistan, the Russians have assumed that some of the training camps were based in that country and maybe in the border area with Pakistan. But in more recent past, a similar lawless area existed in the territory of the Republic of Georgia in the Pankisi Gorge.
Andrei Sitov, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Itar-Tass. Susan Glasser, how do you see it?
Well, look, this is a terrible tragedy, obviously, in Moscow. Striking at the metro system in Moscow is striking at, you know, the heart of the transportation system in this city of 10 million people. It's a major attack. What's striking is that it's the first such attack in the center of Moscow, really, in 6 years. But it recalls a period of time when I lived in Moscow and worked there for the Washington Post, when we saw such horrific attacks on a fairly regular basis. As the war was playing out in Chechnya, it was also playing out in Moscow. And you'll remember this theater siege of Nordos when hundreds of theatergoers were taken hostage. You remember, of course, the terrible attack that occurred outside of Moscow in Beslan, a town outside of Chechnya, where hundreds of school children on the first day of school were taken hostage. Hundreds of them ended up being killed and wounded in the subsequent fighting. But I also think what it represents in many ways is the perils, first of all, to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who has made toughness and ending the conflict in Chechnya with the Islamic militants who were seeking to establish an independent state, an independent emirate, they called it. He's made that a centerpiece of his tough guy rule of Russia. And so in many ways, this represents a major challenge to Putin. Remember, just a year ago, he had his own mission accomplished moment where he declared the end of major combat operations, if you will, in the war down south. And in many ways, this represents the militants' answer to that mission accomplished statement. I found it interesting, Andre was mentioning, you know, was there foreign involvement or not? You know, of course, it's very early. It's very hard to say. But I recall that that's been a major theme and a major trope of official Russian government statements. Each time there's been a terrorist attack, Putin has consistently sought, without very much evidence, to link attacks that seem to come from Russia's internal problem with its own sort of Islamic insurgency inside the country. Repeatedly, they've sought to link it to al-Qaeda, to foreigners, links to abroad, links to Georgia, that sort of thing. I remember, in fact, when it was, I believe it was Sergei Ivanov, during the Beslan school massacre, a dozen or so bodies lined up. He claimed that they were all foreign terrorists in the immediate aftermath. And you know what? Actually, not a single one of them turned out to be. And so I just think it's important for people to take these initial reports with a grain of salt.
Susan Glasser, she's executive editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Turning to you, Steve Andreasen, how do you see it?
Well, Susan makes the very good point that this underscores the political perils at home to Vladimir Putin. But I think it also underscores at a global level that we have a shared threat from violent extremism. And the Russians see that threat, and in fact, they've seen it in the last two decades from the Caucasus. Here in the United States, of course, we've seen it in the September 11th attacks and before and since from al-Qaeda. But this threat of violent extremism has the dangerous potential of colliding with the threat of, in particular, loose nuclear materials and loose nuclear weapons. And in the 21st century, perhaps the greatest challenge we face is to prevent these two threats from coming together and leading to what would be a game-changing event in the international global community, and that is the use of a nuclear bomb by a terrorist group.
Steve Andreasen, he's consultant to the Nuclear Threat Initiative. He also teaches national security at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Susan Glasser, you mentioned Putin, you mentioned Medvedev. Who is likely to bear the responsibility for this attack?
Well, that's, of course, a very good question. Many people here in Washington and around the world are still trying to puzzle out exactly what is the relationship between current Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who, of course, used to be the president, and his protege, who is now the president, Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev has, up until now, steered a somewhat less harsh course, if you will, in the Caucasus. He's replaced a particularly hardline governor with someone who took a different tack, who talked about developing this very impoverished region of southern Russia, for example. But yesterday, both Medvedev and Putin were talking very tough, of course, in response to these terrible attacks. Both of them spoke very firmly about destroying the terrorists. And in terms of their actual policies, we haven't seen that much solid difference. It's not as though Medvedev has really steered a different course than Putin, even if he has sometimes rhetorically spoken in a different way.
Andre.
I just wanted to add here that when we speak about this foreign influence that we mentioned, there is one undeniable factor, at least in my mind, that is beneficial. And that is why I want to say thanks to the United States, not only to the leadership of the current administration that expressed sympathy and solidarity with Russia yesterday with one voice, beginning with the president and on down to all the ministers who have their counterparts in the bilateral commission. But what I mean here is the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm firmly of the opinion that that war diverted attention of the militants, international militants, from Russia, from Chechnya, the monetary resources, the people resources. So in a way, we do see bloodshed, But we would have seen much more of it had the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were not happening.
Susan, do you agree with that?
I do. I think that's a very, I think that is an important point. You know, the original jihad in Chechnya had been a rallying cry during the first Chechen war in the mid-1990s. For example, I think you saw the distribution of videotapes to the international jihadist movement, for example, talking about come to Chechnya and fight. You'll recall that I believe it was some of the original 19 hijackers of 9/11, a couple of them had tried to go to Chechnya to fight and had not been able to reach that very sort of rugged and mountainous region of southern Russia, and then had turned their attention and had gone into Pakistan to the Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan, which it was easier for them to get to. So, you know, I think Andre is making an interesting point.
Steve Andreas, and what is likely to be Russia's response to this attack?
Well, in the near term, I think the immediate focus is going to be on trying to identify the source and trying to provide an immediate and strong and tough response. And again, I think you've already seen the rhetoric of that behind what's being said by Prime Minister Putin and President Medvedev today. In the longer term, the question really gets back to how can you deal with the threat of violent extremism and jihad? And one element of this, and perhaps we're seeing the beginnings of that today, is stronger international cooperation across the board, beginning with the United States and Russia, in particular as it relates to nuclear threats, but also more broadly with respect to intelligence and counterterrorism. So I think in the short term, you're going to see an immediate domestic priority, and that is focus on a tough response, and in the long term, greater efforts at cooperation.
Steve Andreasen, he's with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. We'll take just a short break. We are going to take your calls, your comments, when we come back. And as we talk about the bombings yesterday in the Moscow subways, as well as the new cooperation we are seeing between the U.S. and Russia, here's an email from Rebecca. She's in Brattleboro, Vermont. She said, "It was chilling to hear a report this morning on the Russian response to the bombing yesterday. The government promises to eliminate the terrorists. According to the report, President Medvedev says those involved in an earlier bombing were all killed in police operations. There is no mention made, as there would be here, of investigations or trials or just punishment. Only police action and elimination. It's no wonder there is resistance and unrest in a country where power is wielded with so little deliberation." Andre Sito.
I would respond to that by pointing out that the American Attorney General quite recently said that Osama bin Laden will never face an American court. will never be brought in front of an American court, because presumably he didn't say that. He would have been killed by the troops that capture him. And President Medvedev did say that the previous terrorists had been what he called wiped out completely. I know that there have been calls in my country, in the parliament of Russia, for reintroduction of death penalty, official reintroduction. It's been suspended. It's been suspended, but it's never been completely revoked, because the public strongly supports the death penalty in the situation of a war. And so I don't see much difference, or as much difference as your caller seems to believe exists, between my country and yours.
Susan.
Well, I think it's an interesting analysis. Clearly, there is a tradition of tough guy rhetoric. President Putin often speaks of destroying terrorists. And, you know, of course, he came to power using a lot of what we would consider very colorful language to describe what he wanted to do to terrorists in Chechnya. But I recall a different thing, which is how previous waves of terrorist attacks inside Russia have been used as a pretext for a lot of the elimination of democratic institutions over the last decade or so in Russia. For example, after the Beslan school massacre, you'll recall that President Putin, at the time he was president, gave a very, very hard-edged speech in which he said not only were terrorists going to be destroyed, but that this attack in one small region of southern Russia required the elimination of direct election of governors throughout the entire country, including in far-off Siberia and everywhere in the land. All 89 governors, in response to the Beslan school massacre, are now appointed by the president. So I think what would be interesting to see is whether there are further rollbacks in civil liberties in Russia, whether there are specific legal and structural changes made that would foster a new kind of crackdown inside Russian society as a response to this.
Steve Andreas, and from our perspective here in the United States, it seems difficult to know clearly who's in charge. Is it Vladimir Putin? Is it Mr. Medvedev?
Well, the short answer is I don't think any American has great insight into who's in charge and exactly what that dynamic is right now between Putin and Medvedev in Moscow. I think most analysts believe that Vladimir Putin still plays a dominant role on both domestic and national security and foreign policy. Interestingly enough, in the recently concluded arms agreement between the United States and Russia, it appeared that President Obama primarily was dealing with President Medvedev. So there does appear to be a bit of a division of labor, but it's also true that Prime Minister Putin is not out of the picture. And indeed, what I heard from American negotiators who were dealing with Russians on this new arms control accord is that it was the Russian military who was playing a dominant role, and the perception was that they were quite close to Prime Minister Putin in terms of developing their position in the negotiations.
Is there any indication that the United States and President Obama himself were attempting to undermine Mr. Putin's authority? Susan.
Well, it's an interesting question. Of course, President Obama made a stop in Moscow last summer. He went there for his first trip as president, and he made a point of spending significantly more time with President Medvedev. I think perhaps there was an early sense that if there was some air between the two, that the American administration would like to support the perceived more moderate Medvedev over former President Putin. At the same time, I don't think that they've concluded that that's really a long-term working strategy, but it is interesting to note that I believe President Obama and President Medvedev spoke on the phone something like more than a dozen times over the course of the negotiations on this treaty. On the one hand, that suggests that they're forging some kind of a working personal relationship. The flip side is this New START treaty took far longer to negotiate, despite its relative lack of controversy in terms of the numbers of nuclear warheads, for example, they agreed upon. It took 4 months past the deadline when the old agreement expired for them to come to this agreement, even though, again, the actual substance didn't leave them very far apart. Mm. I think what you've heard from American officials was that they were surprised that it was far harder to negotiate with the Russians than they had anticipated, that their early reaching out and suggesting they would like to have a reset of Russian-American relations didn't quite turn out as they imagined it would.
Andrei Sitov, from the Russian perspective, who is thought to be the leader?
The president of the country is Dmitry Medvedev. Frankly, I don't see how this question is so important. This is more important, I think, to the press. Maybe it is somewhat important to the foreign partners of Moscow, but in terms of the actual governing, I don't see how it is important. I also wanted to make a point in response to Susan's earlier comment about democracy and the liberties rollback. I would strongly encourage anyone who is interested in this subject to compare the records of President Putin and President Bush, George W. Bush, in that regard. Only I would also suggest that please read the original pronouncements and original documents of President Putin on the site, on the Kremlin site, and also think a little bit of why President Putin was so popular with the Russian public.
Fair contrast, comparison, Susan?
Well, you know, I think in many ways these are, you know, very difficult to sort through issues, but the truth is that America and Russia have such extraordinarily different political systems and histories. It's really very hard to directly compare either of the two. And I think that it is also perhaps misleading to an American audience to make that comparison. We're much more familiar, of course, with what's gone on here in the U.S. But I think that, understandably, Russia's far away, and the difficult transition that Russia has had since the collapse of the Soviet Union is not something that has been first on the radar for most Americans. So they have much less context for evaluating and understanding what's going on there today.
All right. Turning now to last week's agreement on the nuclear arms reductions, Steve, talk about the deal to reduce strategic nuclear weapons.
Well, President Medvedev and President Obama, in a phone call last Friday, agreed that they would sign a new agreement on strategic arms reductions April 8th in Prague, approximately 1 year after President Obama's Prague speech, where he said that the United States sought the peace and security of a world free of nuclear weapons. And what this new agreement does is it basically cuts the number of deployed long-range ballistic missiles and long-range bombers so that each side has no more than 800 of those systems, and it limits the number of nuclear warheads that can be deployed on those long-range missiles and bombers to 1,550. This is about a 10% to 30% cut from the last arms control accord, the 2002 Moscow Treaty, which had set a ceiling of 1,700 to 2,200 on strategic nuclear warheads. So a 1,550 warhead limit is a significant cut. It's not a dramatic cut.
It's not a dramatic cut in your eyes.
Yeah, again, a 10% to 30% reduction in strategic nuclear warheads that are deployed still leaves both sides with nuclear arsenals roughly between 8,000 and 10,000 overall warheads.
But how symbolically important are these cuts?
I think it's important for three reasons. One is the new agreement reestablishes U.S. and Russian leadership in the area of nuclear arms reduction. And that's important not just in the U.S.-Russian bilateral relationship as it relates to nuclear security, but more broadly. And we can talk a little bit more about that. Secondly, again, it's the first dramatic sign of U.S.-Russian cooperation. And that, too, has impacts across a broad range of issues. And thirdly, what it does is that it basically sends a signal that the United States and Russia are going to continue to regulate this important aspect of their relationship, That was not the case when the Bush administration was in office. It was not clear that the Bush administration had as a priority the regulation of the U.S.-Russian nuclear relationship. And again, with the expiration of the START treaty last December, that was the 1991 treaty, there was no regulation, no system for monitoring and verification. And this new treaty reestablishes that there will be an ongoing system of monitoring and verification going forward.
Now, what happens on this side? And what happens in Russia to make sure this goes forward? Doesn't the U.S. Senate have to ratify this, Susan?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that, no arms treaty is ever a foregone conclusion when it has to go through the U.S. Senate. Already you see the first murmurings of questions from conservative senators who are asking for more details before they sign off on it, who are waiting to see the language, which hasn't come out yet. John Bolton, who you'll recall was a high-ranking Bush administration official and is a leading Republican voice on arms control, is quoted in the papers today as raising lots of questions, both in terms of, is this a purely symbolic act? Are these reductions significant at all? On the one hand, on the other hand, is there too explicit of a linkage in the introductory language of this agreement, which we haven't seen the actual language yet, but is there too specific a linkage to American plans for missile defense, which is something that, of course, is a very cherished idea of American conservatives in the Senate, and they're sure to raise that in this process of ratification and approval.
Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Andrei Sitov, the Russian Duma, has also to take a very close look at this agreement.
And they have suggested that they will not be rubber stamping it either. I agree with Steve, who sees a big symbolic benefit in the agreement. I like a quote from Konstantin Kosachev, who is the head of the Foreign Policy Committee in the Duma, who said that if before Reagan popularized the Russian proverb «доверяй, но проверяй», which means «trust, but verify», he says now we are shifting to a new mode, or seem to be shifting to a new mode, where it says «verify, but trust». I hope this is so. We'll see if this is so. But the sentiment in the U.S. Congress that Susan referred to in the U.S. Senate, frankly, explains, at least to my mind, why there is some mistrust, I would say, residual mistrust on the Russian side. We, as I guess every capital, regards the partner, the foreign partner, as an entity. And if we are told that, yes, the administration is for it, but we have so many conservatives who are who have their own agenda, and basically it reinforces, first, the same similar sentiments in Russia, but secondly, I think it undermines the key American argument that this is not against Russia. The position of the U.S. conservatives, even under George W. Bush and up to now, I think just undermines that key point.
Now, how do you see that?
Well, I would strike a cautiously optimistic note on the question of Senate advice and consent to this treaty. It is true that at least 8 Republican senators will have to vote for ratification in order to get 67 votes in the Senate. And as we've seen in Washington, getting Democrats and Republicans to cooperate even to that extent has been difficult on a wide range of issues. But Senator Lugar, who's the ranking minority member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, issued a statement last Friday where he basically said he looked forward to early hearings and working with Senator Kerry, the chairman of that committee, to achieve quick ratification of the agreement. So I'm cautiously optimistic that in terms of the reductions, there's a consensus that both sides can live at the 1550 level in terms of a warhead limit, and that the related issues of missile defense as it relates to the agreement and the question of the U.S. nuclear stockpile going forward can be resolved adequately so we can have a strong vote of approval for the treaty.
But the other question involves, I would think, giving President Obama a significant foreign policy victory after his significant health care victory. Susan.
Well, I think that is an important point, Diane. The flip side is this is not going to be voted on right away regardless. And so there's going to be a lot of politics in between the health care vote and the actual vote in the Senate.
How soon do you think that vote might come?
Well, I think realistically they're talking late this year. I mean, they're not going to bring it to the Senate before early May. So I think in that sense, the political environment may well have shifted five or six times between now and then. But I think Andre did make a very important point about really what I would call the persistence of Cold War conservatives in both societies, both in Russia and in the United States. There's a strong built-in constituency in each country and in particular in the political and security elite of both countries that's deeply suspicious of making deals of any kind with the other side. And I think that the persistence of that is a major factor both in the U.S. Congress and also in the Russian military and security establishment.
One additional factor that I think speaks for ratification of this agreement is that the area of nuclear threat reduction is one area in U.S. national security policy where there is strong nonpartisan support for going forward. And we've seen that recently in our own country with the initiative of Secretary Shultz, Secretary Kissinger, Bill Perry, and Senator Nunn to come together in a nonpartisan initiative to promote nuclear threat reduction.
Steve Andreas, and he's with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Short break, your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. This is NPR.
Revamping student loan programs. As part of the health care legislation, the federal government will issue student loans directly, eliminating private lenders as middlemen. What the new system means for students, parents, and schools, the Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll go right to the phones as we talk about the new agreement between the United States and Russia to scale back on nuclear weapons. First, let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Sonny, you're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, how do the two parties in this agreement, the United States and Russia, verify that the other is keeping to the terms of the treaty and not undermining what's been agreed upon? And my second question is, in the term that we're currently in, where there is no treaty governing the nuclear arms of the two countries, is there activity going on to further, you know, their nuclear arsenals during that time?
All right. Thanks for your call, Steve.
Well, first of all, The treaty has not yet been agreed or made public, so the details of the monitoring and verification regime have yet to be exhibited to the public. Having said that, when the White House announced last Friday that the new agreement had been reached, it did say that the monitoring and verification provisions would include a mix of activities, including data exchanges on each side's nuclear forces, exhibits of those forces, provisions in the treaty that would permit national technical means of monitoring, and also on-site inspections. So it sounds as if that's a framework for monitoring and verification that's taken from the 1991 START 1 treaty, although clearly the verification in this new agreement is not as extensive as it was on that accord.
All right. Here's an email from Tony in Washington, who says, if we are partners in fighting Muslim extremists, why has Putin thwarted the U.S. efforts to restrain Iran at every turn? Why should we care about Russia's private war when Russia only cares about selling uranium to Ayatollahs?
I don't think that Russia cares only about selling uranium to anyone. Russia, as other countries in the region, are much closer to Iran than the United States is, and I'm sure that Moscow does not want to see a nuclear-armed Iran. Having said that, I also know that the Iranian threat has been used as a pretext for placing American for at least plans to place American strategic weapons in Europe that Russia believes were ultimately aimed against Russian interests. So that was one reason. And lastly, when I hear people talk about Iran all the time, I know about the Iranian belligerent rhetoric, and I know that it often sounds completely unacceptable. But I also always ask myself, in my mind, how many wars has Iran started, say, in the last 10 or 15 years? How many people has it killed, bombed around the world? How does this compare to the U.S. record over the same time period?
Susan Glasser.
Well, I think one thing that's important to note is that one of the stated reasons for President Obama's policy of seeking a reset with Russia was to secure a greater level of cooperation in working together against the Iranian threat. There has consistently been optimism coming out of the White House that the Russians this time is different. This time we're really going to get them to push on sanctions at the UN. We're really going to work with them to get secure Chinese support for stricter new sanctions. That also has taken much, much longer than the White House thought it would. They originally talked about having new sanctions on Iran in February. Now they're still working on that. It looks like whatever resolution they get will be significantly watered down from what they were originally talking about in terms of collective sanctions imposed by the United Nations. Russia before, of course, has supported three times sanctions against Iran, but nowhere near the level that the previous American administrations had hoped. And I recall as the Bush people were leaving office, that was one of their major frustrations. You know, I remember being in Moscow. We were correspondents there. Bush administration officials would come through and they would say, the Russians are really different this time. This time they're really working with us on Iran. We have to. That's a key strategic interest we have in common. And, you know, they were honest enough to say to us at the end of their time in office, you know, the Russians really didn't actually ever change their line on Iran. Mm. And I wonder if the Obama folks are finding a similar dynamic.
Steve.
They may, in fact, be succeeding, at least in terms of having a shared threat perception between the United States and Russia vis-a-vis the Iran threat, in part because of Iranian actions over the past year. What we've seen happen the past year is more disclosures about a secret Iranian enrichment program and also Iranian intransigence. One of the things the Obama administration has done is basically worked very vigorously on the diplomatic track with Iran. And Iran has not responded positively to that. And I think the Russians see that, and they see the secret disclosures and activities regarding Iran's program. And now the proof will be in the pudding going forward in terms of whether or not that leads to additional pressure on Iran. But I do think some progress is being made.
All right, to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Lance.
Good morning,
Lance, are you there? Let's go instead to Monroe, New Jersey. Ruslan, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my phone
Certainly.
Call. None of your panel members there, none of them, not one single of them, included the Russian ones, does not admit that Russian government brutally oppressing and killing people and disappearing from the jails, including Chechnya, Ingushetia, Dagestan, you can name it. You can go to the human rights groups, you can go to the Amnesty International, they have every, each one of them records. Brutally oppressing people when they get out of the Friday prayers in Juma, which is they call, and killing people, name of security. And 1,599 people disappear from Chechnya, from the jails. Why not one of you have a conscience and tell the truth that Russian government really passing the limit?
Well, I think Ruslan is very impassioned and is citing some reports from human rights groups from not only inside Chechnya but also in the neighboring regions of Ingushetia and Dagestan. I think it is important to remember that an extraordinarily brutal campaign of repression has been undertaken in parallel and in conjunction with the military campaign in Chechnya. Independent human rights activity has all but ceased in Chechnya because of the brutal regime of the Kremlin-approved strongman, Ramzan Kadyrov, who rules there basically as a dictator. There was a very brave woman named Natalia Yestimerova, who was perhaps the last remaining independent human rights activist. She was dragged from her home, from outside of her home last year and killed brutally. I remember numerous people with whom I worked in Russia, including the crusading journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who was murdered as well. And so, you know, speaking the truth to power, having accountability for the extrajudicial killings of people, including human rights activists in Chechnya, is not possible in Russia today, and I think that is an important part of the, terrible anger and passion that has fueled this conflict.
Does that mean that in order to reach this kind of nuclear arms agreement, that the U.S. must put aside those kinds of charges, those kinds of realities, and focus differently? Steve?
No, I don't agree with that at all. In other words, I think those activities need to be condemned by the United States government. They need to be raised with the Russian government. That does not mean that we can't work on areas of shared interest like nuclear threat reduction, where, again, the interests of the United States and Russia and the broader global community coincide.
Andre?
It's obviously a very difficult subject. I'm not with the government. I'm all for all of such cases being investigated and brought to justice. The perpetrators, no matter who the perpetrators are, if they are under the Kadyrov regime, so be it. If they are the rebels, so be it, because in those regions, unfortunately, like in Afghanistan these days, what the Americans are facing, it's the local population is between the two evils.
I want to go back to the signing or the potential agreement on this nuclear arms reduction issue. We've said it must be ratified by both the U.S. Senate, the Russian Duma. Is it likely that this is going to be ratified by the U.S. Senate if it happens before the November election? Steve?
Well, I think clearly the administration is going to try and reach agreement on Senate ratification prior to the November election. They're going to quickly submit the treaty to the Senate. Again, Senator Kerry and Senator Lugar have agreed to hold hearings quickly, and that process should take place over the course of the summer. The key issue is, can they get a vote before November? And that's going to require agreement in the Senate to bring the treaty to the Senate floor, and that usually requires unanimous consent in the Senate, and that could be difficult. A lot is going to depend on whether Republican concerns regarding the treaty as they relate to missile defense, as they relate to long-range conventional strike systems, as they relate to our nuclear posture going forward, can be adequately addressed and agreements reached that lead to that vote.
You see this more as a political question rather than a military one, Andre.
I've been in Washington for 13 years. It's a very long period for an individual human life. It's a minuscule period by history standards. I'm amazed at how much change I have witnessed. And I can speak about this for hours, but briefly, my point is very simple. I believe at this point that both our countries are in a transition period after the Cold War. And I believe the outcome of that period and the outcome of our relations and the outcome of the New World Order ultimately will not be decided on the battlefield. I think it will be decided by the development of political systems internally. And President Obama now leads the charge to transform this country after the Cold War into something new. And his success, the success of his efforts, will determine the place of the United States in the world for the future, will determine whether the United States still enjoys, as some observers, foreign observers put it, the exorbitant privilege of printing the world's money. Nobody ever speaks about it openly in the free and open American press. The exorbitant privilege of setting the world's agenda in terms of information and coverage of the world affairs, including human rights, which is an enormously important issue.
Well, you asked, Diane, about the prospects for passage before the election, and I think that it's going to be a lot easier to pass it if they are able to get a vote before the midterm elections this fall. My, you know, initial guess is yes, but there's a lot to come between now and the vote.
Susan Glasser, she's executive editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Garner, North Carolina. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning. I was just wondering, what are the barriers against including Russia in the European Union or in NATO, and if that's something that either side is interested or working toward?
The question was famously raised recently during Secretary of State Clinton's visit to Moscow, where she was asked about that, whether she could imagine Russia in NATO. And she said, I can, but I'm not sure the Russians can. But interestingly, in the past, I would say, few weeks, I've seen signs from Russian officials of interest in that idea, or at least of seeing how serious and sincere the West is in approaching such ideas.
Do all of you see this agreement as a sign of warming relations between the United States and Russia? Start with you, Steve.
There's a temptation when any new agreement is reached to hold it up and ask, does it solve every problem in any relationship? And the answer, of course, with respect to this new agreement is no, it doesn't solve every problem. But I think it is an indication of cooperation between the United States and Russia on what is still a vital issue for their security, nuclear threat reduction, and global security. And now the hope is that it can lead to greater cooperation on some of these broader fronts. Again, you raised the issue of Euro-Atlantic security and Russia's role in European security. That's an issue that the United States and Russia together have failed to come up with an answer to now for almost two decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the cooperation that was necessary to get agreement on this new START agreement perhaps can lead to a broader discussion of Euro-Atlantic security, and that too can pay dividends in other areas of the security relationship.
Susan.
Well, I think perhaps is sort of the key word in that statement. You know, the bottom line is that we've heard the Cold War declared dead and over numerous times. Actually, it's already been since 1991, after all, that we've been driving a stake in the heart of the Cold War. So it's an easy thing for an American president and a Russian president to stand up on a podium and say, hooray, we've ended the Cold War. It's proved much harder to build a new lasting set of institutions. That said, I think it's important and significant that Russia and the U.S. have learned learn to, in effect, to talk to each other all over again in the long, drawn-out process of negotiating this treaty. I think that's significant. We'll have to see what happens next as a result of that, flexing those muscles for the first time in a long time. But on your last call, I wouldn't waste any time or any mental energy expecting Russia to begin the NATO accession process anytime soon. I think that's just yak-yak.
I would say that it's been a pleasure to be on the panel with all of you. I generally agree. I would say, though, that the Cold War is over, in the sense that the Cold War was about an ideological competition between different ideological systems, and now there is no such competition. We are trying to find a better way, a better future for ourselves and our relations within basically the same framework of ideas and values that we share or we want to share. In terms of agreement, again, with agreeing with what my colleagues here said, I would say that if America believes that the idea is for the others to follow the American lead, then this will probably never happen in this world.
Andrei Sitov, he's Washington Bureau Chief for ITAR TASS. Susan Glasser, she's executive editor for Foreign Policy Magazine, and Steve Andreasen, consultant to the Nuclear Threat Initiative. More, much more talk to come. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.